Thanks, Andy, and good morning, everyone. If I can get this on my belt, I'm sorry. Stick it in my pocket. Ah, there you go. Good morning. So we're starting a new series this morning. It's a series called Apologetics. And apologetics just simply means a reasoned argument in defense of something. And I thought it was lovely what you said about Stuart, and he'll leave really a large gap in our church. And this is something he believed in strongly in his gentle but intellectual style. He will be sorely missed, and I know that he was a great apologist and believer in explanation of the Christian faith. But the intention of these four talks that we're going to do is to really touch on four cornerstones, if you like, of the Christian faith to try and provoke curiosity and encourage exploration. Now, I'm hoping that this will work. If not, we will manage without. Good to see Martin in a cold sweat. Well, I'll just move on. Let me explain about the series. There are going to be four talks. The first one is Made, which is exploring the Christian idea of a creator and the implications it has for life. The second is Exile, and exile and homecoming are big themes in the Bible. And there's something that we know is wrong with the world. There's something that is ill at ease with the world. There's a degree to which our alienation from God has subsequently led to our alienation from each other, leading to racism and conflict. But beyond the alienation from each other, there's also an alienation, I can't say it, within ourselves. We have a deep sense of insecurity about our identity, and we're often driven by that. Our third talk, Rescue. Here we go. Thank you. I'll let you keep plugging away if you're all right with that. Our third talk, Rescue, will center on the Christian story of what God did to put the world right, writing himself into the pages of history to restore what was broken, to drink the poison and reverse the curse. And our fourth one, Home, is really centering on something which I don't think we make enough of in the Christian faith, and it seems appropriate, and Andrew's laid the groundwork really nicely. There's something inside us that, just like that sense of alienation and exile, that longs for something. And sometimes we sense this when we experience beauty or joy, a longing for something that is familiar, and yet somehow we've never known. It would take a longer time to unpack that, and I hope that we'll be able to. But the Bible simply says that God has put eternity into the hearts of man. And this idea of eternity is not just the kind of pie in the sky when you die kind of concept. There's something profound about how we were made, and deep down we know that we were made for eternity. But it's something that brings us hope for now. So we're going to start today looking at the Christian concept of creation, what that means for us. But I want to start with a bit of a caution up front. So much of our public dialogue, nationally and internationally, is very polarized and toxic at the moment. And it seems to be that speakers tend not to listen to each other, but to berate or to try and energize their base. And that's been the nature of public discourse. And I'm really keen to try and avoid that, and we would be keen to do that. And when it comes to the idea of where we come from, brilliant, thank you very much. It won't work. Well, can I have the next slide anyway? And then, when it comes to where we come from, quite often we simplistically separate science and faith as though they're like oil and water and they don't mix. And I think that's something we want to avoid. Christianity is not anti-scientific, and if there was time, we could look at the biblical basis for science and learning, because I think there is one. And I want to show you that as a doctor, I firmly believe in science as being important to things like creating vaccines. But as a Christian, I believe it's really important to have a right understanding of God and where we come from. What I can't stand is theology done badly by scientists and science done badly by theologians. So what I wanted to do today is try and tackle what the Bible says about the creation of the world theologically, and to explore how that biblical picture has implications for us. I don't expect either if you're watching online, or if you're here as an agnostic or an atheist, persuade you of all of what we believe. I just simply want to try and pique your curiosity and if I can do nothing else, perhaps give you the idea that I don't even think that the central few bookshelves through my books that I have a lot of books that I have read and loved and never really shared. And so if I could, I would have bought some to sell, but I want to loan. And I want to go through very briefly, if I can, some of the ones that I have loved and that you might find interesting if you want to explore this further. The first, for Christians on the subject of created things, can I borrow a beautiful system? Thank you very much. This is my favorite book of 2021. So if you're Christian, I really recommend this. 30 chapters, really short. Each one is almost like a mini devotional, looking at subjects like dust, earthquakes, honey, mountains, what the Bible says, what do these things mean, what do they tell us about God. So God of All Things, Andrew Wilson. I will have copies on the back. God in the Dark, Oz Guinness, brilliant writer. Absolutely brilliant. This one's about assurance, but there's another Oz Guinness book that I absolutely loved called Long Journey Home. Quite a thinker, quite a reader, and quite a writer. I really recommend Oz Guinness. You'll have to excuse that some still have my post-its and writing in them, but please do borrow them. And what else have we got? God's Undertaker, John Lennox, An Approach to Science, Has Science Buried God? This one, slight caution, The Devil's Delusion, brilliant book, very clever, very hot on the science, was an answer to the God Delusion by Dawkins, not written by a Christian. That's my only caution, so it's slightly caustic, but it is very interesting and very challenging. Essentially, a non-Christian is making an argument for the plausibility of the existence of God. Philip Yancey, Rumors of Another World. This is exploration of belief for those in the borderlands of belief. I absolutely love that book. C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity, a classic. I'll reference that. Sorry, I should probably move on. Confronting Christianity. I read it fast enough. Thank you very much for lending it. This is not out. 12 Hard Questions for the World's Biggest Religion. I've got two copies of The Reason for God by Tim Keller, who writes in a very polarized society about Christian faith. Anyway, come and see me at the end. I'll be at the back, and please do borrow them. If you're looking at that pile of books and thinking, Ellis, why have you not made up your mind? I just want to say that, to quote Oz Guinness, that a Christian thinks in believing and believes in thinking. I think it's important that we continue to explore. But what I want to do this morning, in the time that's running out, is to dive briefly into the text and give you a few thoughts about Genesis 1. I want to share a few of the reasons I'm not an atheist. And then I want to explore briefly again what the Christian worldview means for us. So if we can move on to the next slide, brilliant, thank you, and talk about Genesis 1. There's a lot of debate whenever this passage comes up about whether it's literal or not literal. I want to make the case for it being not literal and there are a number of reasons, but I want to make it for one very simple reason, in that I think this is written as a poem. I'm conscious that I haven't found a commentator that agrees with that, so you might want to take this not so much with a pinch of salt, but perhaps with a wheelbarrow full of salt. But my case I want to make is that it has stanzas, it has a rhythm, and it has a pattern. And if it's not a poem, it's not far off that. I almost wonder if it might have been a song, something that was handed down generation to generation that tells a story. So when we're dealing with the Bible, as with any literature, you have to deal with it appropriately. So if you're interpreting poetry, understand it as poetry. If it's history, as history. If it's prose, as prose. So, with apologies to Moira, I googled the question, what is the point of poetry? And I wish I'd done this for my higher English. But I found some fairly consistent answers, which are that poetry is a vivid style to convey ideas, emotions in a beautiful or vivid style to help us grow emotionally, intellectually, or spiritually. And that seemed to fit. I think the stanzas are thematic, so we don't need to get into a debate about why the sun appears on day four rather than earlier, and therefore it conveys meaning. I also wondered, how would you try to, thousands of years ago, convey to a Middle Eastern mind concepts of quarks and galaxies, and it would be very hard to do. So I can't think of a better way than this. and the purpose is to convey key truth. I also thought it's really interesting that Genesis 1 has a rhythm. It is counted in days. And it's a reminder that at the beginning, time started too. Now, apparently, our solar system is 13.8 billion years old, but mankind has only been around for about 50,000 of those years. To put that in context, if the 13.8 billion were a 24-hour day, man would only appear in the last 30 seconds before the stroke of midnight. So the scale of this is extraordinary. But here we have a poem that contracts all of that down to 7 days, as if to say all that went before of that 13.8 billion matters much less than all that comes after and all that is conveyed in the Bible after that. So that's my argument for why I think this is not literal, but a description of something that's important in poetic form. It has a shape, it talks about the forming of the earth, the filling of the earth, and then the celebration of all that was made. And if it's a poem to convey meaning, do we think this will work? Here we go. What are the most important messages that it means to convey? Firstly, that the God who was before all things created all things, that he did so in an intentional and involved way, that he created mankind in his own image, and that he acknowledges the beauty of all he had made. Those are four key messages that I think the first chapter conveys, but I want to return to them in a minute and take a slight detour, if I may. And I want to talk about three reasons I am not an atheist. I would have wanted to give you 10, but there isn't enough time. So I'm going to start with three, and they are, if we can have the next slide, thank you. Firstly, I don't believe in the virgin birth. Secondly, I believe materialism is the opium of the masses. And thirdly, they don't believe what they preach. Their criticisms you might have heard leveled against Christianity. Well, let me explain, if I can have the first one. I don't believe in the virgin birth of the universe. I cannot conceive or understand, it's far too much of a leap of faith for me to understand how all of this came from absolutely nothing. And just to try and illustrate with a few quick facts, just in terms of the scale of what we're talking about, in terms of our universe, sticking with the image here, it takes light, traveling at the speed of light, 100,000 years just across our universe, our galaxy. And there are as many as, or upward of, 100 billion galaxies in the universe. Can I go on to the next slide? Or if we take our sun on the far left is 1.3 million times the size of the Earth. And we think it's big, and it is big, but in terms of stars, it's not. There are a number of stars that are far bigger. Antares, the second from the end, is 680 times the size of our sun. But the biggest that we know of, in fact, I think there are bigger ones, I'm not an expert in this field, but this one, VY Canis Majoris, is 3 billion times the size of our sun. Just mind-blowing stuff. Or if we can have the next slide, let's go to the other end of the spectrum. This guy is an orchid bee, and there are 200 species of orchid bee with beautiful iridescent colors. And the really fascinating thing about the orchid bee is the male orchid bee, elegantly shown here with his nice flared hindquarters, has the ability in collecting pollen from orchids to compress the esters, the smells out of each of the pollen, with its back legs in order to create its own perfume to attract females. And no two male bees of this species has. So this guy is the Calvin Klein of the bee world. And we'll probably just want to run through each of the next slides. I could have gone on to mention a whole lot of other features in nature, whether it's in landscapes or in animals, birds, mountains, forests, insects. There just wouldn't be time to be able to describe the diversity, the beauty, the majesty, absolute delight in all of the known world. And I wonder if, looking at all of this, which is breathtaking, the problem is the people who don't believe in God, maybe don't believe or believe in a God that they don't believe in, that is too small. I want to move on to my second reason I'm not an atheist, which is to say that I think materialism is the opium of the masses. Now, just to explain, Marx quoted the original quote, which of course is that religion is the opium of the masses. And I think in defense of Marx, he was meaning as analgesia rather than addiction, something to numb the senses and deal with the pain of existence. But if life is just an accidental collocation of atoms, then there is no moral obligation on any of us, and anything goes. And Aldous Huxley once said, "I had motives for not wanting the world to have meaning. The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world is not concerned exclusively with the problem of metaphysics. He is also concerned to prove that there is no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to do." But in a world without consequences, what is there to stop you moving on when life becomes difficult? New year, new you, say the adverts. Is it time to upgrade your phone or your broadband? Or why not your holiday, your car, your house, your job, your partner? You could spend years of your life chasing things you never knew you never needed. You never have to confront yourself or your shortcomings or your past. So Christianity is an inconvenient truth. It has lots of questions that can't simply be glossed over or ignored. Haters are going to hate. You don't need that kind of negativity, says the internet. Love your neighbors, love your enemies, says the Bible. Confront your shortcomings and your past. And yes, yes, there's comfort in the Christian faith, but there isn't analgesia, and there isn't numbing of pain or forgetfulness. And the godliest people I know hold a deep sorrow alongside deep joy, and the two don't cancel each other out. The third thing I want to say in terms of why I am, and these are personal reasons, I'm not trying to get at other people on the question of why I am not an atheist, is because, and hear me carefully on this one, they don't practice what they preach, which is something you'll have heard leveled against Christians. There's a church in North London. It is an atheist church. They have a pastor who is a stand-up comic. They have talks rather than sermons, perhaps on physics. They sing songs, including Queen songs, probably Who Wants to Live Forever. They don't have prayers, but they have 2 minutes of meditation on the wonder of existence. Why? Is the word that comes to mind for me. If you believe we're only here by pure coincidence and that life is meaningless, then there are certain conclusions that must follow. The first for me is it's all rather pointless. But one day you and everyone you know and everyone they knew will be gone, dead, buried, and history. And in fact, if you go back to that timeline that I mentioned at the beginning, perhaps in just a few more seconds, humanity will cease to exist. After all, the sun will expand, it will eventually implode, and all of life will be swallowed up, assuming we don't manage to do that for ourselves. What exactly is the point of anything? We might as well eat, drink, and be merry, if you can be merry with that thought in your mind. So ultimately, as a logical extension, we have no more right to be here as human beings than the coronavirus. And accept that endless and rather pointless struggle to survive. Tim Keller puts it like this: if your origins are insignificant and your destiny is insignificant, have the courage to admit that your life is insignificant. Atheist philosopher Alex Rosenberg, and I'm going to have to borrow one of these books, in a book, The Atheist's Guide to Reality, Enjoying Life Without Illusions. I realize I borrowed the wrong book, haven't I? It's awesome. Thank you. There you go. I've got one to lend.
to read.
So a series of questions and answers for God and know. What's the nature of reality? What physics says it is? What is the purpose of the universe? There's none. What's the meaning of life? Ditto. Why am I here? Just dumb luck. Does prayer work? Of course not. Is there a soul? Is it immortal? Are you kidding? Is there free will? Not a chance. What happens when I die? Everything pretty much goes on as before, except us. What's the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? There is no moral difference between them. Why should I be moral? Suicide, pagan or forbidden, permissible or sanity or good or evil by logical extension. Yet many atheists, including Dawkins, will argue that you don't need God to be good. Morality is an agreed code within cultures, they say, to preserve our genetic legacy and our gene pool. But morals concern the preservation of life. And if preserving my gene race to survive is what matters, then surely the risk is that my family, my tribe, my race becomes dominant, and we have interracial tension because of that genetic drive. And also, what I find difficult is that all the wrongs that we agree on now, such as genocide, rape, or murder, are not objectively wrong in this worldview, but are subjective and could change. But, and I want to say this carefully, so this was the danger I was worried about being misheard. Atheists don't live like that, and I mean that in the best sense. They pay taxes, they get married, they have families, they recycle, and they make good neighbors, genuinely. But it seems to me at odds with the philosophy. Now, I've had this conversation with atheists who will say, well, see, there you go, you don't need God to be good. It's just one too few O's. But I would counter with a couple of things. Firstly, the Christian theology of common grace. We don't have time for that, but we should expand on that sometime. It's really worth exploring. But perhaps more succinctly, C.S. Lewis would put it this way, and he expands on it in his book. When we do good or discuss good and evil or morals or ethics, even relative morality, we're simply acknowledging that there is such a thing as morality, and in acknowledging relative morality, we are acknowledging that there is such a thing as absolute morality, just as the moral law is as real as the physical laws. So those are the three reasons that I've selected to say why I'm not an atheist, but I don't mean that critically, I mean that as a personal explanation for my thinking. Can we move on to the next slide? Because I promised I would return, thanks, to these four key messages. And I want to finish in the minutes that are left on this. We said these were some of the key messages that came out of Genesis 1. And the first is this idea that God who created all things is a triune God. That was the reason for putting John 1 alongside Genesis 1, to acknowledge that Jesus was there at creation. Christian doctrine of the Trinity is mind-blowing, but really important. What it says is that God is in three persons, and therefore in relationship. And if in relationship, then in long, loving and continuous relationship amongst the three persons. And so Christians can say God is love. But if God was one, and before any creatures were created, there would be no relationship, and therefore, just as he would have to create created being, primary. So the Christian doctrine is that creation was created by a God of love as an act of love. The second, as opposed to an accidental and disinterested way, which means you are not an accident. You have infinite worth just because of that one fact. Peter Singer, who wrote an essay called Practical Ethics, arguing that you shouldn't give humans primacy just because of their species, but primacy should be based on capacities such as self-awareness, the ability to suffer, and so on. And in his own words, and by his own calculation, a week-old baby is not a rational and self-conscious being, and there are many non-human animals whose rationality, self-consciousness, awareness, capacity, and so on exceed that of a human baby a week or a month old. Therefore, the life of a newborn baby is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee. The Christian viewpoint is that your worth is defined by your Creator, in whose image you were made. And that makes your worth infinite, regardless of your age. It also means that we all have the same worth, humanity, in our ethics, in our law, but also in our day-to-day interactions and how we treat each other. Your looks, your is of infinite more value than any of that, and mankind in his image. And it's quite an extraordinary statement that he created beings with reason, with will, with freedom, with creativity, with character and humor. These godlike, literally godlike creatures were created for relationship with him. Now bear in mind the way in which God acts and intervenes to correct that wrong takes our value to a whole new level. And Mother Teresa, as you know, worked with destitute people in Calcutta, used to teach that every human, no matter how broken, was worth serving because they had the image of their Creator in them. That was their worth, no matter how they looked. So it should transform how we treat other people. And Martin Luther also argued that it should transform our work. We're made in the image of a working God, a creative God, and so all that we do is transformed by that and given value, no matter how menial our work. The final point I want to finish on is that God acknowledges, in the passage we've read, the beauty of all that he has made. And that repeating phrase, "it was good," is an objective observation, but it sounds a little bit like God is marking his own homework. But I think there's an open invitation for us to mark his homework too. So when we admire a view, a part of the countryside, an animal, Oakley, or a piece of music or work of art, we're doing something profound by invitation. Andrew Wilson says that creation preaches to us, the things of God reveal the God of things. And they should draw our eyes upwards in wonder to our Creator. The second and final point I just want to add under that heading of God acknowledging the beauty of what he'd made was that by extension that statement was made about you. He is delighted with you. You can try and get your head around that. So we've got more to explore and recognize that there are lots of questions that will be provoked. We've only just skimmed the surface of something. And you'll be thinking, but this and but that. But please do come and borrow a book off me. I want them back. Once you've borrowed them, feel free to give them to someone else. They need to be in circulation, they need to be in use. I will take a photograph so I don't lose any and remember what I've got. But I really want them used, borrowed, and enjoyed. So please do borrow them off me. Final thing I want to say, from the Christian perspective, we started with the amazing wonder of creation. But from the Bible story, the Bible really says, if you think the first act is good, you should see what he does next. Thank you.